We're talking with Nick Redfern, whose book, Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind, is packed with stories that are chilling to the bone. When we come back, we'll talk about a string of scientists who died under mysterious circumstances. Then we'll open up the phone lines with your questions for my guest. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Nick, I wanted to give you a chance to wrap up the story about the MK Ultra guy, unless you're about done with that one.
No, that's fine. Yeah, this is Frank Olson, who was one of the major players in the MK Ultra mind control, mind manipulation project that kicked off in the early 1950s. And as I said before the break, Olson was someone who mixed with people in the UFO field almost as easily as he did people in the mind control angle as well. Now, as I talked about before the break, the controversial theory is that some UFO events may have been fabricated using sort of mind-altering technologies born out of MKUltra. And as I said, the significant thing is that Olson was actually linked with various people in the UFO subject. Now, one of them was a man named Andrija Puharic, who was someone who was actually an American of Yugoslavian descent and who claimed to have been contacted by extraterrestrials. And he had something called the Round Table Foundation in Glen Cove, Maine. But Puharic was actually also a captain in the U.S. Army at the Edgewood, Maryland-based Army Chemical Center, where a lot of the MKUltra research was carried out.
He's always I'm sorry to interrupt, but he was also a played a major role in the Uri Geller story.
Exactly. And Frank Olson met with Puharic on a number of occasions to discuss his work in the field of chemical technology in terms of mind manipulation and the UFO subject as well. And there's another story about how in 1954, there was a wave of very strange UFO sightings in France. It coincides with the fact that just a couple of years earlier, Frank Olson had been in that very area of France discussing with French intelligence agents how the mind could be manipulated and altered, because the French government was interested in this as well. And then it's kind of intriguing. We have this outbreak of UFO activity in that very same area. So we have a lot of things like this. As I point out, the before the break, if people who might not have heard it, the Pascagoula case of 1973 involving two men in an abduction, Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker. Their experience occurred just a couple of miles from a place where BZ, a highly hallucinogenic substance, was tested. So we have, again, the strands of what I think potentially could turn out to be a much bigger story.
In that same vein, I remember reading about this string of scientific deaths, Marconi Electric Systems. In fact, it might be more than one company associated with a string of deaths, but this is the one that you mentioned in Chapter 10 of your book. What kind of work were these guys doing, and why would you classify their deaths as mysterious?
Well, they're all good questions. It all goes back to the early 1980s when President Ronald Reagan, envisaged the whole Strategic Defense Initiative program, as he called it, or SDI, or as it was more famously known, Star Wars. And the idea was, it was a very grand and ambitious program where we would have like a huge laser-based armada orbiting in near-Earth orbit. So in the event that the Russians or the Chinese launched a sneak nuclear attack, these laser-based weapons could actually just obliterate and blast out of the sky, disintegrate any potential nuclear weapons launched by somebody else at the US. Now, the program, as I said, was a very grand and visionary one, but it may not have sort of reached the potential that the presidents perceived that potentially it could. Now, this coincided with Reagan making a number of public statements on the UFO subject and talking about how if there was some sort of alien invasion, it would unite us as a species. And you can find many of these lectures online. They're actually filmed. And he does make these comments on a number of occasions. Clearly, to me, it seems like he was trying to get the word out, so to speak. Well, bear in mind the SDI work and Reagan talking about hostile aliens. Marconi, an English company that does which is now actually incorporated into another company today, but does a lot of high-level work for the British Ministry of Defence and the British Royal Air Force, the military, etc., on weapons systems and things like that. Marconi was actually contracted to work extensively on the SDI program from varying different disciplines. And what's intriguing is that between 1982 and 1991, no less than 31 scientists and personnel working for Marconi, many on the SDI angles, died under mysterious circumstances. And by mysterious circumstances, I mean out-of-the-blue suicides, jumping off bridges, car crashes where, in one case, for example, a man just had normal life and then just one day just loaded the trunk of his car with gasoline tanks, hit the highway and slammed into a deserted cafe at like 80 miles an hour and just blew himself up. Another one put a rope around his neck, tied the other end around a lamppost, got in his car and hit the accelerator and decapitated himself. There are others who electrocuted themselves in very bizarre fashions. Another one actually died from carbon monoxide poisoning in his car when he was supposedly cleaning the car inside the garage with the door shut, which was a bizarre thing to do.
That same guy had almost died earlier, right?
Well, that's one of the very strange things, that the same guy almost died in a car accident just months earlier. And it was a very weird car accident where he couldn't figure out how it had happened. And there was actually some talk of that privately he told family and friends it was as if something had taken control of his mind and had almost forced him to crash the car. But he prevented that from happening, only to die, as I said, in his garage weeks later. Now, a controversial theory for all this surfaced from a man named Gordon Crichton, whose story I tell in the book. Gordon Crichton was the former editor of Flying Saucer Review magazine, a long-standing journal going back to the 50s, but he was also a former intelligence officer with the British military. He came to believe or suspect that the intelligence behind the UFO phenomenon was actually using a kind of mind control to wipe out the SDI scientists. In other words, if SDI, as some people believe, wasn't just aimed at targeting the Russians or the Chinese, but some people believed it was actually targeting hostile extraterrestrials, hence Reagan's warnings, the theory is that the extraterrestrials themselves decided to turn the tables by wiping out the SDI scientists. And it has to be said that there is evidence that mind control did play a role in some of these deaths and bizarre events. Aside from this one, where the guy survived one near-death experience only to then, have a fatal one, there was another case where one of the scientists found himself wandering around France. Lived in England, but found himself, of all places, wandering around France in a haze, in a daze, not even sure how he got there, as if some sort of hypnotic spell had been, sort of instilled in him. And the number of cases like that, and as I said, there are more than 30 between 82 and 91. And on such a scale, for me at least, coincidence goes out the window, but the British government stubbornly refused to suggest there was anything to it beyond accidents, heart attacks, depression, and so on. But when you look at the overall picture, clearly there was more going on than that. And I think Gordon Crichton's scenario of, mind control actually being undertaken by hostile aliens to prevent the SDI program going ahead, it's sort of a fascinating and disturbing one at the same time.
Well, the odds of more than 30 guys working in that one little sector of the defense industry on the same kind of project, that the odds would be off the charts. Add in a case like you had one instance where a guy, he eventually died. He killed himself. The guy was in the with the engine running and the garage door shut. But a year earlier, he almost killed himself when he was cleaning his gun while it was loaded.
Yeah, this was another case with a Marconi guy, died in his garage from carbon monoxide poisoning. But just a few months earlier, the Yukawara had been cleaning his gun when it was still loaded, and he's actually pointed at his chest and shot himself and fortunately survived. But he, afterwards, was sort of chilled to the bone. He actually said he couldn't figure out how his mind could have got into such a state where he would have cleaned the gun while it was loaded and pointed at him. You know, very, very strange. And although I don't mention this in the book, this really kind of parallels the deaths of dozens of microbiologists around the world, many in the US, since early 2001, who've been studying exotic viruses and so on. They've kind of dropped like flies, just like the Marconi scientists as well.
You make the point in the book, too, about these Marconi guys, is that not only were they dying off in strange circumstances, but there was also a series of UFO events. I mean, some people tried to explain them away as maybe the IRA had helicopters, which seemed to be a bit of a stretch that they had silent helicopters. But, you know, for the sake of argument, I guess we can include it. But there were at least a couple of intrusions over the Marconi facility, right?
Yeah, I talk about this in the book where I actually reproduce one of the documents from the British police force that talks about these, as they call them, sort of phantom helicopters or mystery helicopters, because they didn't really know what they were. But they were essentially unidentified flying objects seen over key Marconi installations. And, you know, I don't think that's a coincidence, because one of the installations was the very one where this guy who shot himself in the chest was actually working, and in the same time frame. And, you know, so it's, I think there's a major story here on the Marconi scientists that we've really only seen the tip of. You know, we know of the deaths. What we don't know is, you know, all the background information and what the government itself may have known or suspected that possibly could have been along the lines of Gordon Crichton, you know, sort of like an alien assassination, so to speak.
Oh, man, that'd be a great movie. But it's sad for the families of the people that happened to. We'll take a call or two, and then I have a ton of more questions. East of the Rockies, Bonnie in Florida. Good morning, Bonnie. You're on with Nick Redfern.
Good morning, George and Mr. Redfern.
Hi,
my husband was a roommate with Thomas Mantell when they were both cadets in the Air Force.
Oh, my gosh.
And he told me about this, and he said that Thomas Mantell was an extremely intelligent, good pilot, and that he would never do anything stupid. And actually, the story that I had heard previous to the time I met my husband was that this UFO was hanging over Fort Knox for like a week or two. And so they didn't know what to think about it. So somebody, I don't know who, maybe the government or somebody, asked Mantell, who was, he and his group were ferrying planes from someplace. They were together, and they came in, and somebody asked him to check out the UFO that had been there. So he said yes, he would. So several of the fellows went along, but some of them turned back because they thought they didn't have enough fuel or something. And Mantell, being the brave person that he was, he chased after it. So evidently something happened to him then. But my husband knew his wife before they were married. Her name was Peggy. And he said there was another one of their roommates who later became an attorney, and he helped Peggy try to get to collect the insurance for Tommy's death because they couldn't prove how he died. Now, I had a picture of my husband and Mantell together, and I had it enlarged, and I sent a copy to his son, whose address I had at one time. I think he lived in Kentucky at the time. And so I've lost the picture. I don't know where it disappeared to. But I thought it was an interesting story because my husband had known Mantell, and that was long before I met him. But he said he was a very intelligent, super good pilot.
Wow, Bonnie, that's a great call. Good information. Nick?
Yeah, that is. That's an excellent. Thanks, Bonnie. You know, I mean, that sort of vindicates what so many other people have said, that, you know, contrary to the idea that Mantell just openly mistook Venus for a UFO, which in the middle of the day when Venus really wouldn't have been in view is sort of absurd. And this goes back to the fact that Mantell was a highly trained and well-respected observer and pilot. And in that sense, this just adds to it. You know, when you get corroboration like this from somebody like your husband who, you know, who knew him personally, then that, for me, is the sort of thing we always go looking for as a UFO researcher, is where, you know, you can actually add something really significant to the story.
Thank you for the call, Bonnie. You know, I mentioned earlier in the show about Edward Ruppelt, who was the head of Blue Book, and who he sort of had an interesting transformation, or actually a couple of them. He investigated the Mentel case. He said, you quote, I forget what the exact words were in the book, but about it being weasel words, how the Mentel case was explained. Ruppelt, who was sort of an apologist for Blue Book, he went along with the program for a while, changed his mind, and then changed his mind again. And then, as you note, he died under somewhat mysterious circumstances. Tell us that part of the story.
Well, yeah, Ruppelt was the first head of Project Blue Book, as it was known. He actually was a successor to Project Sign and the previous one called Project Grudge, which actually Ruppelt also worked on Grudge as well. But it was really with Blue Book that he came to the forefront. And he was someone who sort of took an enthusiastic and proactive approach to the subject, and actually came to believe that, you know, some UFOs were genuinely probably extraterrestrial. And he wrote a book called The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects, which is a fascinating study when you realize it's actually been written by somebody in the military. Now, you're quite right, George, that after a few years, he changed his views and became a little bit more jaded on the subject. And in future editions of the book, his views were sort of modified and altered. And it is a fact that in 1960, he died of a heart attack at just 37. It was actually his second heart attack. Now, you know, unfortunately, you do sometimes find people die of heart disease at a young age. Maybe that's what happened, but then on the other hand, maybe it isn't. You know, we just don't know. But what we can say for sure is that this was another person who, a major high-profile figure within the UFO history, who died young.
At least the story I had heard. I mean, I've got copies of that first book, and it's a masterpiece. You know, he was very sympathetic. This is a legitimate topic. Mm-hmm. There are real mysteries at work here. And then he sort of did an about-face in the later versions of it, and kind of downplayed the whole thing. And the stories we've heard is that he was about to do another one, another about-face, and return to his pro-UFO position, and that's when he died. I don't know if that's consistent with what you've heard or not.
Well, yeah, I've heard those rumors. And, you know, I mean, it shows the sort of, you know, the smoke and mirrors side of things, where clearly there are things going on in the background where we're not seeing the full picture. But I do find it intriguing that Ruppelt did have this sort of back and forth approach to the subject. And there have been rumors that pressure may have been put on him to sort of retract his fairly startling, you know, open view on the subject to one that was more skeptical. And, you know, maybe that had some bearing on the overall outcome as well.
We barely have touched on the mutilations subject. You mentioned it just in passing earlier. If we get time, we'll jump into that, because it's one of the most chilling parts of your book. The new book is Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll go back to the phones. Got a couple of people hanging on, and then touch on a couple of other cases that you mentioned in this book, and it's way more than we can cover in the course of a couple hours. But good stuff here with my guest, Nick Redfern. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with one of Paul McCartney's countrymen, Nick Redfern, about his new book, Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind, some pretty weird stuff. And when we come back, we'll go back to the phone lines with your questions in our final segment. Stay with us for more Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to our final segment with Nick Redfern. We go back to the phones on the wildcard line, Mihilo in Los Angeles. Good morning. You're on with Nick.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay.
Thank you for taking my call. This is not a question, but I have a piece of information, possibly, for Mr. Redfern. I haven't read his book, but I knew Dorothy Kilgallen and her husband, Dick Colmar, and their son when I was teaching the son at boarding school in Phoenix, Arizona, called Judson School. And they had a radio program in the morning called Dick and Dorothy. It was a breakfast program, and it issued from their brownstone on 67th Street in Manhattan. And she died under mysterious circumstances just after the assassination of Kennedy. Nobody ever knew. It was diagnosed as cancer. Now, she was perfectly healthy. And all of a sudden, she died of cancer. So I just wondered if he had that piece of information. And I think it's a small but interesting sidelight. Oh. She knew quite a bit about what was going on. She was very knowledgeable and quite a personality. She wrote for the New York World Telegram, which was then, I mean, there are very few papers, but that was one of the newspapers that was extant at the time.
Oh, yeah, she was a major figure, very popular across the country. Nick?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, thanks for that. That's very interesting. And you're quite right that she did die under very questionable circumstances, and it just sort of adds to the catalogue of unusual deaths that surround the Kennedy assassination. And although she was sort of primarily portrayed as, you know, she took part in a lot of game shows and was a gossip columnist, she was actually a very skilled investigative journalist as well. You know, it wasn't just sort of lightweight Hollywood gossip, although that was what she was more well known for. She was actually sort of a very good journalist. And I actually got hold of her FBI file, which runs to nearly 200 pages, and is filled with, you know, copies of her articles that intrigue the FBI and again demonstrates her skill as a regular journalist.
I think she was really good because she had good contacts. Mihailo, she was well-connected, right?
Yes, I think that's the best way of putting it. She was connected pretty high up.
Thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Go ahead, Nick.
No, I was just going to add that, you know, in terms of the overall story, this is sort of just, you know, another piece of the puzzle. And I think the more pieces we get, you know, one day we're going to get there, hopefully.
Thank you for the call. Appreciate it. We didn't touch on this, but only briefly, human mutilations. The evidence is not as solid, I think, for these cases as in other parts of your book, but you do touch on this, and it is at least intriguing.
Mm. Yeah, well, I felt it was an important issue to touch on, George, because people have spoken about human mutilations, kind of similar to the so-called cattle mutilations. And the main reason I wanted to include this was to see if it would, you know, open further doors if people read the book and have knowledge of it. But the human mutilation cases are certainly less than the cattle mutilation ones, which sort of literally run into the thousands. But the reports are very similar in terms of organs being removed and sexual organs, eyeballs, tongues, lips, that kind of thing. And the stories are pretty grisly. I talk about one that reached Leonard Stringfield, who was a longtime UFO researcher, but also a former US Air Force intelligence officer. And he was given a story from Cambodia, the height of the Vietnam War in 1972. This was April 72. When reportedly a team of U.S. military personnel came across a landed UFO surrounded by a number of what were clearly alien creatures, reportedly loading human bodies and body parts into these large bins and then supposedly loading them onto the UFO. Now, granted, it's a controversial story, but Stringfield went on record as stating that it came from not just a friend, but someone who was a high-ranking military source that he trusted implicitly. And he didn't reveal his name, unfortunately, but Stringfield said that he had no doubts about the person and as a result didn't doubt the story. And I think one of the major problem with the human mutilation issue is that it's very much under-investigated. Don Ecker did some good research on the subject in the late 80s and early 90s, but overall it's been ignored. It's just, I think, it's gone under most people's radar. A lot of people just don't realize it's a legitimate phenomenon. But I think, you know, more digging, we might be surprised at what we turn up.
I remember Don Ecker, who's a friend and colleague and a hard-nosed investigator. He had a case, I think it was in Idaho. You mentioned that in the book.
Oh, yeah.
As I recall, a couple of hunters who found a body or something.
Yeah, you're right. This was actually it was between Bliss and Jerome, Idaho, in 1979, and it was two hunters. They came across the body of a man who was dead under very weird circumstances. He didn't look like he'd been sort of attacked by a bear or a mountain lion. It looked like expertise skills had been used, if that's the right word, skills. He was missing both of his lips, one ear, and his sexual organs. And it looked like it had all been done with surgical precision. And, you know, when you have rogue cases like that, it really does sort of push the subject down a very sort of sinister path.
Well, if you were wondering why there's no disclosure or why somebody doesn't come forward, maybe that's part of it. And it's not only an occasional mutilation here or there, but you got a heck of a lot of disappearances if you cast a wide enough net.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you look at the overall angle of UFO disclosure, I think, I support the people who are really doing the research into this and pushing to get disclosure.
Yep.
But I think, I often think that not much thought's given to what might actually be disclosed beyond the fact that aliens exist and maybe we've got a few bodies and crashed UFOs. You know, the bigger issue of missing people, you know, deaths, human mutilations, when the door is opened, if it is opened, I think some people may have wondered if we should have left the door shut. I think we should know the truth, but I think there could well be a lot of dark and disturbing things that come along beyond just, yes, we are being visited.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I mean, I fully believe in it. I strive for it. I work for it every day. But you know what? If the truth comes out that we are food or we're a farm, I'm not sure that people really are going to be ready for disclosure.
No, and I think this is the main issue, that if it was just that we'd had a few weird visits back in the 40s and something crashed but they didn't attack us, now we've decided to tell you. I could see coming out under those circumstances, but I think my personal view, speaking to people, is that something about the subject that's very disturbing has been learned and a decision has been taken. There's just no way we can tell people that, you know.
We're on the same page. Going to Dave in Pittsburgh on the wild card line. Good morning, Dave. You're on with Nick Redfern.
Hello. I'm a first-time caller, but a veteran of Coast to Coast since Art Bell.
Welcome.
I could tell you a bunch of my UFO experiences, but since you're talking about the mysterious scientist passed away, well, there was one that I don't know if you mentioned it before, but he was the lead singer for Aaron Butterfly, which he was, his father was a physicist. And so is he. But he developed a way to send a message to outer space and back at a quick time. And all of a sudden, he came up missing, and they found him in a desert in California. Well, they found his bones, actually. And
Iron Butterfly. What was his name? Do you remember his name?
I'm not sure what his name was, but he was the lead singer for Iron Butterfly. I'm going to say his first name was Doug, but I'm not sure. And I thought I heard Art Bell speak about this years ago.
Nick, does this ring a bell?
Yeah, it actually does. I don't know the full details, but the story was definitely written up in a UFO magazine a few years ago, and he was found dead, and he did have a tie to the UFO phenomenon, and it was an unusual story. But I'm sure, you know, if you put it into a search engine, you know, you'll find it. But yeah, there were some UFO themes to the whole story, yeah.
Appreciate the call, Dave. That would be pretty interesting if the lead singer of Iron Butterfly was a physicist, or his dad, even if his dad was the physicist. I'll throw out another name, Nick. You don't mention this in the book, but I know that it's a name that I get asked about all the time because of the possible connection to Area 51. It's Phil Schneider. Are you familiar with him? Because a lot of people say that the circumstances of his death, and I haven't investigated them, were pretty strange.
Yeah, the only reason, people have asked me if I include Schneider's case in the book. I don't, not for any reason other than the fact that contractually I was limited to 65,000 words. I could not exceed that. I could have actually made the book like 90,000, but that's just one of those things. So, you know, I was forced to, you know, to leave certain things out that I could have actually put in. But Schneider's death, I mean, was a very weird one. You know, but the interesting thing about Schneider was he was actually speaking quite openly about the Dulce story, Dulce, New Mexico, and the claims of underground installations and, you know, hostile extraterrestrials, and a lot of it tied in with the Paul Benowitz story that surfaced in the late 1970s with, again, with cattle mutilations and an underground facility at Dulce, New Mexico. And Schneider, you know, his death was put down to suicide, but when you look into the intricacies of it, it doesn't appear to be a suicide at all. And that's interesting because, I mean, in terms of when it occurred, it's relatively recently. You know, we're talking 1990s. We're not talking, you know, 1940s or 50s. What this demonstrates is that things are potentially still going on in terms of, you know, unusual suicides, suspicious deaths, and so on. I think I've seen a trend where I don't think there are as many today as there were in the past, and I think that could well be because, as you pointed out earlier, George, how the subject's been diluted and sensationalized and so on, that there's no need anymore. And I think that's an interesting trend, that perhaps in the early years there would be more of motivation than there would be today, when it's become more part of popular culture and filled with disinformation and, unfortunately, hoaxes and whatever else.
Well, you know, this, your theme, I mean, you do cast a wide net, but it, there's a temptation, I think, in the UFO field to ascribe every death to, well, that's, he must have died because the evil secret government killed him. Yeah. Bill Cooper is an example. I mean, you know, Bill Cooper, I was the first guy to interview him on television, and he, I know how he died, and he sort of brought this on himself, but I mean, it wasn't because he was spilling beans on UFOs that he was killed. There is a, there risk of thinking anyone who's ever studied the subject who dies, it must be because of what they knew.
Yeah, and I point this out in the book, but, you know, I was very careful as to what cases I used and which ones I didn't. And the most important thing is to note that, I mean, over the decades, there have been literally probably tens of thousands of people who've had an interest in the subject that's involved research or subscribing to journals or, you know, signing up with MUFON or whoever, writing books, et cetera, et cetera, and they've lived perfectly normal lives. And I think, but I think there is a trend to these deaths, and I think it's where someone, I mean, if you look at the death of Forrestal and JFK, if the UFO connections to their deaths are legitimate, they would have been people in a prime position to reveal something of major significance. And I think there are other people, certain researchers, who may have been in a similar position as well, and like Morris Jessop. And I think it's those cases where somebody may have decided there was no alternative but to, you know, to ensure that they didn't say anything again about anything at all. And on top of that, I think there are also certain cases where, for example, we talked about this sort of silent war that may have gone on back in the 50s, where there was literally, you know, so many aircraft disappearances and mysterious crashes that that's the reason we don't really see that anymore today, because I think the engagement has gone away. We've kind of got the message to, you know, to stay away. So I think, you know, that in terms of which deaths are suspicious and which ones aren't, we need to be sort of very careful. I mean, somebody actually asked why I didn't include the death of a friend of mine, Matt Tonis, who wrote a book called The Crypto-Terrestrials a few years ago. And one on The Face on Mars called After the Martian Apocalypse. Mac died in his sleep at just 34 in 2009. Well, you know, the reason I didn't include it was because Mac actually had heart disease. He had a number of experiences of faintings and dizziness a long time before he actually died, and he was trying to get treatment and so on. And then, unfortunately, he did die. So it's kind of like very occasionally, unfortunately, you see a footballer die on the pitch or during training, you know, at 25 or something. It happens, and we're all human, and UFO researchers are human first. And sometimes a death is just a tragic death. But I think you're quite right, George, that a lot of people assume if there's a death in ufology, it's got to be sinister. But for the most part, they're not. You know.
Well, we all go. I mean, you know, we all go at one point. Yep. Try to get one more quick call in. East of the Rockies, Jonathan in Atlanta. Good morning. You're on with Nick. You got about a minute.
Evening, gentlemen. James Forrestal's death definitely seems sinister. Did he ever speak out publicly about UFOs? And if so, what did he say?
Well, he actually didn't speak out publicly about UFOs. But what is interesting is sort of the time frame of when he was Secretary of Defense. For example, Forrestal actually began working in the Pentagon on September the 23rd, 1947. That happened to be the same day that General Nathan Twine of the Air Force prepared one of the most now famous UFO reports or documents on UFOs, in which he said the phenomenon reported is something real and not visionary or fictitious. Now, 24 hours after that, September the 24th, Forrestal met with not just President Truman, but a man named Dr. Vannevar Bush, who has been extensively linked with sort of secret UFO programs. And so, in other words, we do have like a timeline where Forrestal was mixing with key figures in the UFO field as it relates to the government. And so although he didn't speak out publicly, we can place him with the right people at the right time.
Thanks, Jonathan. Appreciate it. Nick, we've got just a little bit of time. You've not had the knock at the door. I mean, my general feeling is that, you know, the UFO topic has been so diluted by so much overload that there really isn't a whole lot of danger in talking about this stuff anymore, that whoever the bad guys are, they don't really care if you write a book or if I do a radio broadcast about it. Do you agree?
Yeah, I actually do, because, you know, those of us who sort of report on it and talk about it, we're sort of on the outside looking in. I think the people who in the past at least had to worry were the ones on the inside who were thinking of coming out, like Forrestal, possibly like JFK, and also people like Boris Jessop who stumbled on something that may well have, you know, led to his untimely death. But yeah, I think in today's world where ufology has now become part of pop culture, and on top of that it's been diluted, like you said, it's a case probably more that we kept an eye on, I would think, but not to the extent, you know, where it takes on sinister proportions.
I'm gleeful in my agreement with you. Nick Redfern, it's always good to have you on the show.
Thanks, George.
I hope people will check out your book, Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind. Should belong in your UFO library. It's good stuff, and there's a lot of topics we didn't even touch on. Thanks also to my earlier guest, Lee Spiegel, and to my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Nathan Staton, Gina Salvati, Dan Galani, webmaster Tim Binal, and producer Chris Boros. And I'll see you next month. Good night, everyone.